Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 2nd of November. It is Election Day here in beautiful downtown Milwaukee. It's a beautiful day. The only thing we're going to say about politics, can you believe it, on this day? But we want to be fair, and so we're not talking politics. Tomorrow, baby, we're doing a full 2 hours on what happens. We'll be concentrating on the state races, the first hour of our program tomorrow, and the second hour, we will look at the national races, so stay tuned for all of that. The only thing I want to say is, and I wish my son well, who is voting for the first time today. I feel like he's getting married or something. It's so, such a big thing to be able to vote. So he's away at college, and I know he's looking forward to that experience as well. First hour of our program today, the authors of Madison and Jefferson, a book that has just been released. And the authors, there are two of them, say that the title, because the title is Madison and Jefferson, is not meant to be cute or ironic. It is not to degrade Jefferson as a force in politics, not one iota, but rather to suggest that it is time to reevaluate their relationship and their distinct individual contributions. Popular historians have done precious little with Madison, and while political scientists have boiled him down to his noteworthy contributions to the Federalist Papers, the historians who place him within the larger context of party formation have presented Madison as a man unaffected by an emotional life, a man eclipsed by the more magnetic and more affecting Jefferson. So this book, they say, is an attempt to bring back overlooked elements in a panicky political culture that dangerously provoked as often as it positively motivated Madison and Jefferson and those who fell into their circle. Joining us this hour to talk about these noteworthy people in history, these presidents, early presidents of the United States, Andrew Burstein and Nancy Eisenberg. They are Charles P. Manship Professor of History and Professor of History, respectively, at Louisiana State University. Burstein is the author of six other books on early America, including The Passions of Andrew Jackson and Jefferson's Secrets. And Eisenberg is the author of two prize-winning books, Fallen Founder, The Life of Aaron Burr, and Sex and Citizenship in Antebellum America. We want to let you know that because they have Wisconsin connections. So many people do who are on this show. Nancy got her PhD in history from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Andrew's son graduated the University of Wisconsin 2 years ago with a journalism degree. So that's cool. All right, here's our phone number if you'd like to join the conversation. It's 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. Professor Eisenberg, Professor Burstein, thank you so much, both of you, for being with us.
Oh, we're happy to be with you. We're going to be talking about politics today, you know. nobody who's running for office anymore.
I know we're safe today, but it sure is a story of politics, isn't it? And so much more. You know, there are two times in American history, I guess I have concentrated more on the Civil War, but it is absolutely remarkable to think about what these people were doing, founding a country and thinking about what the principles are that should guide the United States of America and fighting the British. It was just such an extraordinary time, wasn't it?
Yes, and one of the things that we're trying to recover in explaining their relationship is it's often forgotten that Madison and Jefferson grew up in central Virginia, the Piedmont section of Virginia, 25 miles apart. And since you mentioned the Civil War, one of the things we focus on is that these two men were Virginians first and Americans second. Now, that may seem surprising, but we tend to forget, one of the things we tend to forget about American history is that they were once colonies, and their identities as colonies continue to shape how they behave politically even after the American Revolution. So for both of these men, when they considered policies, when they considered issues, they often talked to their circle of friends from Virginia and always considered how would this issue play in Virginia. So we even have the emergence of sectional divisions at this period, which is something we often later associate with the Civil War.
When they wrote the word United States, it was a lowercase u and a capital S.
Oh, interesting.
Because they understood the preeminence of the states in the Union, and that the Union at the very beginning of this country was not secure. And, we tend to read into the founders as great intellects, which they were, but they were also hard-nosed politicians. And they fought tooth and nail for what they believed in, and very often what they believed in was rooted in a self-protective impulse about protecting their states against what they saw as the potential for their states to be, the power balance would shift, and one section of the country or one populous state or one economically privileged state would subordinate the rest. So that calculus was in place from the very beginning.
You write early on in the book that, and I think that this goes counter to what the common wisdom is about these two, that neither Madison nor Jefferson was truly a man of the people in spite of their press. What were they?
Yeah, I think this is another important theme. We have to realize that they were country gentlemen. They were raised as part of the elite planter class in Virginia. And we often associate Jefferson with the yeoman farmer. But this was an idealized, romanticized image that Jefferson had and it tends to be associated with the idea of democracy. But that's an incomplete picture. Really, when Jefferson actively engages in his first massive experiment in reforming government, it's when he's involved in changing the laws in Virginia. And he still imagined, and what he wanted to achieve in Virginia, he did want to shift the power structure away from a very small planter elite, but he still wanted an educated elite to have power within Virginia. And Madison was very similar. When he is thinking about devising a new structure of government, when he's putting together the Virginia Plan, which will later be proposed at the Federal Constitutional Convention, what he really imagined was that an intellectual elite would have most of the power. Believe it or not, the proposal that he put forward, most of the elements were rejected. And that's why we also challenge the idea that Madison can be seen as the father of the Constitution. But what he really wanted, he wanted the Senate to be the most powerful body, and he wanted the Senate to be composed of an intellectual elite. So that's why we really have to be careful and not equate them with celebrating small-d democracy. They were distrustful. They realized that power could be abused in various places in society, and this is particularly true of Madison. And this is one of the themes that we try to highlight in our book, is to not just simply equate them with the kind of government that we have today.
Mm-hmm. Well,
they didn't want to give each individual or each man a vote. There were strict property requirements. This was not a social revolution in 1776 or 1789. It was a political revolution insofar as it replaced the governing elite. It was no longer appointed by Britain. It was a homegrown elite, but they were still elites. They were still, there was very little opportunity for people to rise on the basis of merit until decades later. And this is in a sense what Jeffersonian democracy, as it's commonly known, brought about, was a very slow, gradual rise of modestly born people, but they were Jefferson and Madison themselves, while they engaged with ordinary people on a regular basis, because in their 3-mile-an-hour world, they traveled from place to place very slowly. They stayed at inns. I mean, it took Jefferson 3 days to get from Monticello to Washington when he was president, and he would stay at an inn, and he would sometimes share a bed. theirs was a very different world. So, yes, they did, meet with ordinary folks on the road, but they didn't believe, as Nancy says, in small-d democracy.
Yeah. You even write, and it gives us a sense of the difference in the way people live then, this slower kind of pace. Both men, I love this sentence, were excellent dinner table companions, affable and unhurried. This was the one social function they were bred for and excelled at.
One of the things that people don't know about James Madison, when we think of him as the egghead founder, is that he had a raucous sense of humor and also a kind of racy, vulgar sense of humor. He told stories. When we look at portraits of these men, we think of them in their powdered wigs, or we think of them with quill pens in their hands, and that they're
right.
always thinking.
Yes.
They had, Jefferson and Madison could joke, and we try to recapture some of that as we humanize the two of them.
Yeah. Well, we have to ask the obvious question. You call the book Madison and Jefferson. We just overlook Madison these days. Why in the world do we do that? Why do we spend so much time on Jefferson?
Well, I think part of it has to do with the kind of letters that they've left behind in the archive. Jefferson, and his letters are still being edited, had a very rich vocabulary. He has the kind of writing that is captivating and moving. Madison's prose is more businesslike, and he is more of a pragmatic politician. So to understand Madison, it takes a little bit more work. And I think that what we've tried to recover in Madison's life, and this is something that we're always dealing with history, we're always trying to overcome the conventional wisdom or the myths that get recirculated and recycled. And because Madison is often called the father of the Constitution, as I said, even though that's not particularly accurate, it leaves Madison, first of all, very few Americans truly understand how the Constitution works. It seems intellectually imposing. So we associate Madison with being this brilliant man, but someone who's opaque, someone who's harder to understand,
mm-hmm.
Where Jefferson seems more open and his letters seem more inviting. And what we wanted to recover Madison, particularly in the 1790s, the importance that he played in Congress. He is instrumental not only in helping organizing the Constitutional Convention and getting Washington to attend, and we often forget that Washington and Madison were extremely close at this crucial moment, so close that when Madison is in Congress, he not only drafts George Washington's inaugural address, but he writes the congressional response to Washington's address. And he's instrumental in the very early days of establishing the new federal government. He's the one who comes up with the idea of a cabinet. He's the one who recruits Jefferson to make sure that he'll come back and serve as Secretary of State. So he is instrumental, particularly on the floor of Congress, and at this early moment in shaping the government that tends to be forgotten and overlooked.
Mm-hmm. In the 1790s, the opposition, the Federalist Party, as the two parties formed, and Madison and Jefferson coalesced a group of anti-administration political minds, the opposition was called the Madisonians, not the Jeffersonians. They were sometimes abbreviated, particularly in satirical newspaper stories, as the Mads, Mad Democrats. And, so the emphasis that subsequent generations have placed on Jefferson, and I've written two books on Jefferson. I mean, he's endlessly intriguing. and I don't mean that in a politically sinister way.
Mm-hmm.
But Madison was really the leader, in a sense, the inventor of the two-party system, the leader of the opposition. He both, as Nancy just said, he both introduced the Washington administration, kind of set the stage for the administration, and then within two or three years becomes the chief opponent of that same administration that he had helped to build. So that's the centrality of Madison. It doesn't end with the Constitutional Convention or the ratification process in the states. Madison is a partisan politician, and that's what makes him so fascinating. That's why he takes top billing in the title of our book.
Interesting. Tell me more about how they helped further each other's careers.
Yeah, this is also very interesting. It's trying to understand the relationship between the two men, and that's why we think of this book as both a political drama and a dual biography. And I think it's really interesting because it's more like real life. We get to see how these two men interacted. Often they're in different places, the second guessing, the intellectual process of how this relationship evolved over time. And one of the things that we highlight is that it's Madison as Andy just mentioned, who takes the lead in the opposition. He's the one who first challenges Hamilton, not Jefferson. Jefferson is in the cabinet, and he is following Madison's lead. But what's just as interesting is that it's Madison who recruits his college roommate to set up an opposition newspaper. He writes for the newspaper. Jefferson does not. And when it comes to finally thinking about how they have to put together some kind of ticket to run against Washington, and by this time, Jefferson has retreated from politics. He's back in Virginia. He's very reluctant to re-enter the political fray. It is Madison who has to convince him to run. And this is a real interesting moment. This is in 1796. Jefferson says, well, why don't you run? And Madison refuses to do so. He convinces Jefferson to run. And then he begins to take on this role as campaign manager and political advisor, which is also a very interesting moment in the relationship.
Campaign manager, isn't that something?
We should back up just sure. for a moment. Nancy, of course, was talking about the election of 1796 when John Adams narrowly defeated Thomas Jefferson for the presidency, and Jefferson, as a result, became vice president. But to back up just for a second, Nancy touches on one key point here that I wanted to underscore, which is that their friendship did not begin just because they were Virginians and neighbors. It was political necessity that brought them together, and they were thrown together in a way in the late 1770s when Jefferson was elected governor of Virginia, and Madison was named to his council advisors. The governor had very little power at the time, and Madison, as an advisor, had a very important role in shaping policy for the state of Virginia. During the darkest days of the American Revolution, Virginia was invaded by Benedict Arnold. There's a whole story there. But the way they come together is that they both, from 1776, speak out vocally against religious bigotry. And their political bond forms around what becomes in 1785 Jefferson's draft of the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, which Jefferson is in France as American minister at the time. It is Madison who pushes it through the Virginia Assembly at that moment when he sees a chance to get this done. So it's their friendship, their personal intimacy evolves and deepens, but it really is about shared purposes initially in the state of Virginia, and then after 1790 on the national stage.
And tell me more about this campaign against religious bigotry. What were they referencing here? What was that?
Well, what we tend to forget is that in Virginia there was a state church, and in other states there was. It's called religious establishment. In Virginia, it was the Anglican Church, which we now call the Episcopalian Church. And what that meant is that that church owned a great deal of land. It had particular privileges. You could be taxed to support that church. And both Madison and Jefferson felt that this church had too much power. They associated, it's called the Anglican Church, they saw it as a colonial remnant of English rule, and they really supported the idea of religious freedom. And this is why it's quite ironic that today for example, in Texas, they took Jefferson out of their textbook because they saw him as supporting the idea of separation in church and state. But without Madison and Jefferson and the efforts that they made to support religious freedom, the religious denominations that these people in Texas often belonged to, the Baptists and the Methodists, the evangelical religions, would not have been able to flourish. So that religious freedom is really central to their thinking, and it's a perfect example of how something in modern politics is completely misunderstood about
right.
the role that they played.
Let's welcome phone calls. And we are speaking this hour with the authors of Madison and Jefferson, just released. Andrew Burstein and Nancy Eisenberg are our guests. They are both professors of history at Louisiana State University and have written, both of them, a number of other books on American history, particularly the Revolutionary era. Here's our phone number. Join us if you'd like. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up tomorrow during this hour today, in case you didn't know it, is Election Day. And so we're going to talk about the result of the many state races tomorrow during the 9 o'clock hour. At 10 o'clock, it will be the national races. So that's coming up tomorrow. Second hour of our program today, Robert Wirth, Beirut Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and Charles Schmitz, who's Associate Professor of Geography at Towson University, to talk about the failed plot and terrorism in Yemen. That story keeps continuing with news today that there may have been a dry run for that in September. So that's coming up, hour number two of our program. Let's hop to phone calls. I love you as an audience. I just say, here's the phone number, and the phone lines are just jammed to talk about Madison and Jefferson. That's just great. Let's go to Mike in Milwaukee first. Hello, Mike.
Winston Churchill wrote a book called The Great Republic, which confused me. Hamilton was a New York capitalist who believed in a strong central government. He hated the masses, and he hated the idea of democracy. According to this, Jefferson, who was an agrarian, was a populist, believed in states' rights, that the state should be more stronger than the central government. Now, in today's world, the capitalist wants states' rights, and the democratic populist seems to favor a strong central government. So I don't know where I am. I don't know where I live anymore.
Andrew and Nancy.
Yeah, I think that this is part of the problem, the way in which politicians of our day appropriate certain rhetorical tropes, which may not really reflect their own experiences. And this is what we're trying to say about even Madison and Jefferson or Hamilton. One of the things that also drew Madison and Jefferson together when they critiqued Hamilton's policies is they really did foresee a kind of crony capitalism. They saw Hamilton not only creating a strong national bank, but creating a commercial merchant elite class with ties still to England, as well as creating a strong relationship between this financial class and the executive branch, and particularly Alexander Hamilton. And they saw this as dangerous. They also saw it in sectional terms, since Virginia was principally agrarian, but Virginia had its own problems, which is slavery. And this is one of the other issues we try to deal with, is that Madison and Jefferson never, they tried to engage with the slavery issue. Colonization, the idea of sending slaves outside of the state, ended up being their solution. But it's not a solution to us. And in many ways, we see them, as time passes, as becoming less willing to tackle slavery. Again, because they realized that Virginians politically would not support them, and this would undermine their political position. But the caller is right about the contradiction that exists today.
Yeah.
It's always, we have a tendency to want to draw parallels between then and now, but it's invariably ahistorical when we try to do that. The problem conceptually is that, Madison and Jefferson were skeptical of big government, But for them, their world was one in which the largest city contained 30,000 people. And as I said before, news traveled at 3 miles an hour. So, you know, for us to try to imagine them weighing in on modern post-industrial America, it's just, you know, it's really fruitless.
Yeah. Can you give me a more nuanced description of Madison's views and perhaps writings on race? We tend to know a little bit more about Jefferson's rather complicated views on race and complicated personal actions. What about Madison?
Yeah, this is also something we compare the two. I mean, Jefferson's views, he always viewed slavery as something that was more emotional, visceral, that slaves carried memories, and that eventually that if emancipation happened, this would lead to a race war. Madison was quite different. We don't find that emotional baggage when he's writing about slavery, and we find some really amazing things about Madison. When Jefferson and Madison made their trip to New York, Madison recorded observing a free black man who was a laborer, who was running his own farm, who was extremely successful. He had white laborers. And Madison marveled at this. And one of the things we find about Madison is he could see that free blacks did have the potential. They had the same desire for liberty. They could achieve the same things as whites. What held him back is he believed that whites in the United States would never tolerate it, and that's why he began to advocate colonization as a model experiment to prove to people in America that blacks could achieve as much as whites.
You know, both Jefferson and Madison in Philadelphia saw a thriving black community. So, you know, Jefferson, yes, he was married to his theory and reluctant to change. Madison could treat blacks as, in effect, social equals at his own dinner table. But in a national political sense, Madison was took advantage of what Jefferson first promulgated in his Notes on Virginia in the 1780s was recolonization of all freed slaves back to West Africa. Jefferson said to prevent a race war. Madison was thinking, you know, that's not the way I see it, but I know Southerners, white Southerners, I know how they think, and so politically it's not feasible. What is feasible would be if the blacks went back to, or you know, gradually went back to West Africa, proved that they could establish flourishing colonies of their own and economically strong, they would be trade partners of the U.S., then the racist U.S. South could see the success because of the increase in commerce between the two societies, could see that they had nothing to fear. And sometime in the distant future, blacks and whites could live together side by side in a combined economy in the U.S. But, you know, again, it was all theoretical for them.
Oh, my. What a plan. Let's go next to Mike. Thanks for your call. Tom in Galesville. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to hear from the authors on Jefferson and Madison and on the Federalist Papers, why they decided to write this, you know, meat on the bones of the Constitution. Why do it in the first place, and their thoughts on that?
Yeah, the Federalist Papers were written by Madison, Hamilton, and John Jay. And initially, Madison wasn't going to be involved. It was Hamilton. They were geared for a New York audience. And what we tend to forget is that at the time that the Federalists were written, and they're mainly written to try to influence the New York State Ratifying Convention, very few people paid attention to them. They were mainly propaganda. They were an attempt to engage in the newspaper war and gain support for the new federal constitution, particularly in New York. What we've discovered that's interesting is that when Madison gets involved in writing the Federalist Papers, he circulates them in Virginia, and a lot of the essays that he writes are attacking George Mason, who had been at the Constitutional Convention, had actually been in the Virginia delegation, had supported Madison at first, but then refused to sign the Constitution. George Mason is a very important intellectual in Virginia. He played a major role in shaping the Virginia Constitution. And when Madison returns and is in the Virginia State Ratifying Convention, the two people he's up against are Patrick Henry and George Mason. So this is why we also try to recover the immediate political interest, the fact that Madison does not write the Federalist Papers to influence jurists in the 20th century. He's writing them to shape the political context that he's involved in at that moment. And the Federalist Papers, particularly Madison's favorite Federalist Number 10, is not really discovered and not considered important until the 20th century. This is where legal scholars and political scientists have exaggerated the significance of these documents and not understood how they really mattered at the time they were written.
A lot of the book includes the relationships they had with prominent people in the Revolution. It was a somewhat troubled relationship with Patrick Henry, as long as you brought him up. Do you want to detail that a bit?
Yeah, we love talking about Patrick Henry because he was the most popular Virginian in Virginia. And for his entire life, he died in 1799, just a few months before George Washington. For his entire life, he was a permanent thorn in the side of both Madison and Jefferson. he stopped James Madison from becoming the first United States senator from the state of Virginia in 1789. He pitted Madison because of his influential role in Virginia, and he was governor of Virginia. He pitted Madison against his friend James Monroe and forced the two of them to compete. Madison won that election. Madison became a congressman in 1789, 1790. But that's where Madison and Henry tangle. For Jefferson and Henry, it goes back even further. Because while Jefferson at first looked up to Patrick Henry, when they met, Jefferson was 20 years old, off to college at William and Mary in Williamsburg, and Patrick Henry was this kind of rustic, larger-than-life figure who would unleash, get the ball rolling for the Revolution with his kind of theatrical oratory. I mean, he had no military experience, but he expected to be leading troops just because he was like the Pied Piper. People adored him. They followed him. And what Jefferson really tested him for was at the conclusion of Jefferson's governorship in 1781. Patrick Henry was instrumental in accusing Jefferson of cowardice in running from the British, in abandoning his governorship, and it left a stain on Jefferson's reputation that he fought for his entire life. So Henry is, in some ways, a more vehement critic of Madison and Jefferson than Hamilton ever was.
Hmm. Let's go to Connie in Portage. Hi, Connie.
Hi. I don't know if this has been asked, but since you've researched Jefferson so much, I wondered, is it true did he never ever mention Sally Hemings in his writing?
Well, yes, it is true that he never ever mentioned Sally Hemings in his writings, at least nothing that has been preserved. My previous book on Jefferson, called Jefferson's Secrets, goes into this in great detail. We know what DNA has discovered, the likelihood that Jefferson fathered the children of his slave. But what we do not know is what emotional tie there was between Jefferson and Sally Hemings, and that's what I detail in that book. To know as well as we can what Jefferson's views of human sexuality, of his privilege as a master, as a patriarch, but bottom line is that Jefferson gives us a very polished sense of who he is in his correspondence. And he does correspond with John Hemings, Sally's brother, who is a skilled carpenter and who Jefferson relies on closely. But you know, aside from the intimacy that he clearly had with the entire Hemings family, there's nothing in the written record that gives us any clear impression of any relationship between Jefferson and his slave.
Let's spend a few more minutes on Virginia and the Declaration of Independence. You write, which I found intriguing, Virginia was on Jefferson's mind when he composed the Declaration of Independence.
Yes. Well, what's interesting is he really was more concerned in getting back to Virginia because they were going to start the process of, you know, drafting the Virginia State Constitution. Again, he thought that was more important than the Declaration of Independence. And this is where we have to remember the way in which they saw their states. And what we also stress is that Virginians, the joke that we make, the Virginians were the Texans of the 18th century. They were the biggest state. They imagined that their territory was as far as the eye could see. They were very expansionist. They acquired Kentucky in 1776 almost as a quasi-colony, and that goes hand-in-hand with slavery. Part of the problem with growing tobacco is that it makes the soil infertile, and that leads for a need to expand. And Jefferson and Madison's fathers were involved in these land speculation companies, as were many other of the prominent founders from Virginia, like George Washington. So this, as and Patrick Henry. So the issue for them is that Virginia interests, I mean, even the idea of getting involved in the American Revolution had been sparked by the fact that the British were creating a barrier and not supporting the idea of settlers moving west. And this was a very important issue for Virginians. So this is where we have to emphasize that Jefferson, at the time he wrote the Declaration, he didn't imagine it was going to become an important document the way it did. He's not a prophet. But his immediate concerns were shaping the future of Virginia, because Virginia was a powerful state, and he wanted to, you know, he was also deeply concerned with getting back and revising the laws in Virginia and shaping Virginia into his model republic. He was thinking about that much more than the United States. Mm. As model
in fact, when Jefferson wrote of Virginia, he called it my country.
We are going to welcome more phone calls for our guests here in just a moment, and emails as well. We have an interesting email that asks a question about Robert Bork's Supreme Court confirmation hearings and his views that he was a Madisonian majoritarianism. We'll go to that email and take more phone calls in a moment. Our guests this hour are the authors of Madison and Jefferson. Andrew Burstein and Nancy Eisenberg are our guests. They are both professors of history at Louisiana State University and authors of other books. Burstein has written six other books on early America, including The Passions of Andrew Jackson and Jefferson's Secrets. And Eisenberg is the author of Fallen Founder, The Life of Aaron Burr and Sex and Citizenship in Antebellum America. Again, our phone number, a couple lines are open now, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This seems an appropriate time to tell you just briefly that we are going to Washington, D.C. I'm taking a group of listeners to Washington and Gettysburg March 30th through April 5th. So that's next spring when the cherry blossoms should be cherry blossoms in Washington. We're going to have a wonderful trip. We're doing a broadcast from the National Public Radio studios, and we're going to be going to Mount Vernon. We'll be doing Gettysburg. We're going to go to the Smithsonian and many other museums, and we're going to have a great trip. And part of the big part of the trip is being with listeners, because you all share a love of history and you're great companions, as Madison and Jefferson were good dinner table companions. So if you'd like to get some more information about this trip, and it came about because we went to Springfield last year, and we polled people on the two buses that we took, and they said, let's do Washington. So we said, all right, And we're doing Washington because you told us to do Washington. So we're going. But we're starting to fill this trip up, which is great. If you think that you might be interested and want more information, please call Progressive Travel at 800-231-4391, 800-231-4391. Our guests on this election day, Madison and Jefferson, they are the authors. They're not the guests, but we are talking with the authors of the book, Madison and Jefferson. And welcoming your phone calls. Let's go to an interesting email. This is from Dennis in Janesville. During the Bork Supreme Court confirmation hearings, he repeatedly referred to his philosophy as Madisonian majoritarianism, which seemed to get past the committee. But the inference I got was that the Supreme Court should reflect the public majority's will. In my mind, that is exactly the opposite of what should guide them, as in the tyranny of the majority. How did Bork get this idea from Madison?
Yeah, this is a perfect example. Even though Bork is one of the original promoters of original intent, which has come under scrutiny and has been challenged and has evolved over time, the problem with calling someone, you know, a Madisonian majoritarian is it really eclipses what Madison really believed in. From the very beginning of his career, he believed in protecting minority rights, and this was a fundamental difference between Madison and Jefferson. Jefferson believed that tyranny came from the top. Madison was concerned that tyranny could come from the bottom, it could come from states. Later, he imagines power could shift, tyranny could come from the executive branch. But throughout his career, he was deeply invested in protecting minority rights in the same way he believed in protecting religious freedom, that the state should take an active role in protecting minority rights. So I think that what Bork did was invent a category that really didn't exist, or in some degree he may be conflating Jefferson and Madison, because Jefferson more fell into the category of defending rule by the majority. And there's a wonderful letter that's written between Madison and Jefferson in 1788, where they letters that they exchange, where they articulate their different positions. So Bork's category is an invented category that he created for himself, which reflected his thinking rather than really reflecting accurately Madison's thinking.
We go next to Janice from near La Crosse. Hi, Janice.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Thank you to your guests. They're absolutely fabulous. They're just so intriguing to listen to and so knowledgeable. I just want to thank you again. Love to have you come on again. Anyway, my question is just that I keep going back, or I wish they would go back again to the notion of the separation of church and state and how we have gotten to this point in our country. You know, for me, I don't know. I mean, I'm Catholic, so this is really hard for me to have this. It's almost like a paranoia now to speak about God or anything. And I feel like we've just put a wedge in between our country, and then they say, well, it's in the Constitution, you know, separation. And then, no, it never was in the Constitution. But why do we have this? To me, we've really driven a hole right down the middle of our country, and our founding fathers were never intending this. So anyway, I understood you before in the beginning, but I just feel today this has become a huge issue. And you can't even say, you know, can't imagine Jesus Christ for anything. It's like, oh, delete.
Well, if I can start, take a dainty step into this very complex and divisive subject.
Yes, it is.
We don't like, as I said earlier, drawing the parallels between, you know, what they would think about today. But we can certainly say that the anti-intellectualism of the extreme right would have been about the most depressing aspect of today's political noise for Madison and Jefferson. For them, all of the people that we refer to as the founders, that is to say, the principal, the best known of the founders, were men who practiced religion conventionally, as a socially. They attended services because, as prominent members of their community, it was the gentry's, you know, obligation in a way, a sense of showing who you are. Having kind of a condescending, which didn't have as bad a connotation then, a condescending manner.
But they believed in the American Enlightenment. They believed, they worshipped science, not religion. And you know, Jefferson especially wrote of Jesus as a supreme moral teacher. So you know, explaining that Jesus never claimed divinity, and they were content with that. They saw God as a workman creator, the deist God, and this is John Adams, this is Madison, this is Jefferson, this is, you know, a good many of them. They would invoke God only, you know, or God's providence in a not in a literal way, but in a way of just expressing patriotism. You know, it's not to be taken as literally as some would prefer to.
Yeah, I think there's always this problem in this country between how people think about religion personally or how they practice religion, and then how religion is used politically. And we can even see that difference because, as we tried to argue, that Madison and Jefferson believed in supporting religious freedom. Madison believed in protecting religion as the right of a minority. He was very supportive of the Baptists in Virginia. He did not want a state church. But in the election of 1800, a very heated and contested election between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, many Federalists used religious rhetoric to attack Jefferson. They called Jefferson an atheist. They quote from Notes on the State of Virginia. And this is one of the problems that we have with religion in this country, and this occurs at different moments in our past, the way in which religion is used as a political weapon. And this is the problem we have today. When religion gets confused with politics, it is divisive.
Yeah.
It is used as a weapon of attack. It's rarely used as a theme to unify Americans.
The epigrammatic statement that Jefferson made. He said, "It does me no harm if a man tells me there is no God or there are 20 gods. It does not pick my pocket. It does not break my leg." This was, you know, nothing was more important to him than rights of conscience.
Oh, that's interesting. We just have a few minutes left. Could you round out who, just a little bit about their personal lives? I mean, we know one was tall and one was short and wasn't very well, but Jefferson particularly suffered some huge personal losses, and Madison had an interesting background. Can you talk about who they married and who died and how hard it was, considering their personal circumstances, to carry on?
Okay, well, I'll start with Madison. With Jefferson, and Nancy will tell you something about Madison's personal life. Jefferson was married in his late 20s to a younger widowed woman who had a child who he would have been stepfather to, but who died before they married. His wife, Patty, they were married 10 years. She died as a result of childbirth. She was pregnant 6 times. By all accounts, it was a very tender, loving marriage. We know Jefferson was a widower for the rest of his life. He never remarried. He could have married another woman of the Virginia upper crust. For whatever reason, he chose not to. And we now know pretty much definitively that he went on as a sexual man. The losses he suffered, besides the children who did not live to adulthood, a best friend who was the first to be interred at the gravesite at Monticello, was also his brother-in-law and someone who he looked upon as a comrade in arms at the as the revolution was about to take place. For Jefferson, friendship, especially male friendship, was extremely important, and he made efforts to bring Madison and Monroe closer to him by selecting lands near Monticello that he wanted them to settle on. Monroe did. Monroe was his true protege. Mm. And Madison always resisted,
You know, it was Jefferson always reaching out to Madison, and sometimes Madison kept himself at arm's length, which is kind of interesting. Mm.
We'll take care of each other when we get old. That would be nice. And we have about 45 seconds. How about Madison, Nancy?
Yeah, Madison is interesting because he didn't marry until he was in his 40s, 42. He had been engaged to Kitty Foyle, who was 15 years old. I mean, this would be considered
goodness
gracious
today. Yes.
But that relationship was broken off, and then eventually he's introduced to Dolly Madison by Aaron Burr, and that leads to their marriage. There's clear evidence that they try to have children, but they are incapable of having children. But Madison was devoted to Dolly. He did everything possible to help her son, who had a scandalous life, was a gambler, and he wrote very passionate, loving letters to Dolly Madison, and later years, she's helping him put together his papers.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. Thank you both. We could go on for hours. There's so much in the book. Madison and Jefferson is the name of the book. The authors are Andrew Burstein and Nancy Eisenberg. And we thank them for their time. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing and Chrissy Peace for on-air production.